Today on the Cooligans, what a big one. Pellegrino Matarazzo got hired by La Real. I just learned how to say his name. Wait to hear the episode. It's an absolute incredible. Why did he take this job?
And in the second and third segments, we're going to be talking to Franklin Leonard, the creator of The Blacklist. We talk Hollywood. We talk Real Madrid. We talk England. We talk it all. He is the person that he comes to us when he needs to talk about footy and get anything off of his chest. So we do all of that today on The Cooligans.
Okay, so my wife and I took my mom and her mom to Rhode Island this weekend.
Oh, I saw a photo.
Yeah.
They looked very happy.
Oh, you know, they loved it. It was a three-hour drive. Me in the front seat, my mom's new car. She's very happy about it. She drove a total of 100 miles since she's owned it for the past like 4 weeks. She's afraid to drive it. She's like, I just keep driving my older car. And I'm like, you have to put oil in that every 2 weeks. Stop doing that. It's going to leave you on the side of the road. She goes, well, when it dies, I'll use the new car. I'm like, you're paying for something for no reason. Uh-huh. We're taking it to Rhode Island because you're supposed to do a nice long drive when you get a new car anyway to, like, you know, get all the systems going. So we're sitting in the car.
New rule I just heard about right now.
You didn't know that? You should go highway miles. Do like 200 or 300. You don't need to go all the way to Rhode Island, but you should do like a significant drive when you first get a car, because there's like oil pressures and all these things that if you're just doing city driving, it doesn't ever really build. Anyway, long story short, I'm in the car. It's my mom. It's my wife's mom. It's my wife. It is a yip fest. So I go, you know what I should do? I'll put on a little music. This will be a little something for me, you know? And apparently, did you know that music, even at the lowest possible level where it could just be heard in the background, doesn't allow people to talk in the car? So I had to shut that off and sit silently while everyone else in the car just had a blast for about a 3 hour drive.
But I don't understand. You are also a pretty big yapper as well. Why wouldn't you want to participate?
See, this is okay. This is the thing. And I think you said it correctly. I'm a yapper. They were yipping. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Yipping and yapping are two different things, bro.
right. It's a different language, really.
Honestly, when you think about it, it's like, it's the difference between Cantonese and Mandarin. They're both speaking Chinese. They can't understand each other. You know what I mean?
Got it.
There's not a lot of overlap.
A little dialect difference.
Bro, they're having conversations about family members' health. And, oh, my cousin did that. These are conversations I have zero interest. They're not talking about like, oh, look at this on the side of the road, or oh, did you hear blank got murdered? There's none of that. You know what
I mean?
Right,
the fun stuff.
Yeah, this is like, you know, like the phone conversations you hear your significant other have where you're like, I don't even care about the chief man. You know what I mean? I don't even want to listen into this half of the conversation, and I certainly don't care what's on the other half. Imagine that live in a car. While you're driving for about 3.5 hours.
Damn, bro.
It sounds stereotypical, right? It sounds like I'm doing a bit from the 90s.
Right, women talking to each other. Hey.
The problem is, they be shopping, you know? My problem is, I can't do nothing. I couldn't turn the music on. And then my wife decides she's going to take a nap. So my mom and my mother-in-law in the back seat, they talk a little bit lower. I go to turn on the radio. Again, a little something for me. My wife wakes up. Turns it off, goes back to bed. It disturbed it. I can't do nothing. I was basically an Uber driver. I was an Uber driver and restaurant decider.
Okay, well, you know, own your role and do as you're told.
I honestly did.
All right. Well, all right, cool. Why a 3 hour trip to what's in Rhode Island that you needed
mansions.
To see? Mansions. Mansions. Oh, the wealth that we'll never have.
What's the point? Let's go look at places where richer people lived, nicer than anything we'll ever live in, and we can't afford. And let's be surrounded by a bunch of people I don't think a lot of people showered that day. It was one of the smelliest group of people I was surrounded by.
In the mansion or
the tours. You're doing tours.
Ah, I didn't know this.
So like the Vanderbilts have a mansion and they ran out of money. In like the 70s or something, in like the 30s or 40s. They ran out of money recently. Anderson Cooper's granddad.
Yeah, yeah.
right? Like these very fancy. It's weird. When you go to Europe, you see like pictures of people and they're like paintings or something from like the 1700s who own like, you know, Count whatever owned this mansion. And you're like, oh, wow. You go to one in Rhode Island and it's like the guy's on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Like it's not distant enough for me. You know what I mean? Like it's weird. Like you have a photo in color. You know what I mean? The camera, it's like no. You got to be black and white only, dog.
if the crimes you committed to gather that wealth feel further away. It can't be in Technicolor.
Like if the crimes you committed are more like biblical in nature, I can't be upset about it because I wasn't really involved.
It was so long ago. I wasn't even a concept. Right.
Like the crimes you committed were like post Eisenhower, like dog, ew, dog. I don't want to be in your ill-gotten mansion. I don't care about your floral designs.
Right. I mean, okay, you use modern technology to get you to gain your wealth. So not cool. All right,
it is a little disgusting. Although one cool thing happened: a lot of rich people from the Carolinas, and we know how they got their money. I'm not interested in that, but a lot of rich people from the Carolinas.
You're looking
used to
host
go
your
up,
wedding, any particular spot?
Actually, Taylor Swift rented out apparently all of Rhode Island for her wedding. Coming all right. up, so whatever. She got Tennessee money. I don't want to know how her family got it as well. But apparently they would go up there because there was such bad malaria in the summer in the Carolinas. Mm-hmm. They would go up there to escape that, but also to get a cool breeze, right? So I was thinking about, like, what's the modern-day version of that? Like, you're up there in the border between New York and New Jersey, mm-hmm. right? Living your suburban dad life right now. If you wanted to do a little getaway, the weather's kind of changed. Where would you go? Where would you go if you said, you know what, this summer's a little hot, let's go somewhere cool? What's an option for the Polanco family?
What's the place called in Boston or the Boston area, New England? Why am I forgetting the name? The island or whatever.
Martha's Vineyard?
No, not Vineyard. The other one. What's the other one?
Me to know fancy places in Boston?
I'm blanking on in New England the where you get your lobster rolls and stuff like that.
You talking Portland, Maine?
No. Cape Cod.
Cape Cod.
Thank you, Carter. Cape Cod. Cape Cod was lovely. The only problem is there's only one way in and one way out. That one little bridge, and you're just like on traffic. You're sitting in traffic for in or out. There's just one line.
I didn't think the Polangos were this fancy. They're Cape Cod. You're going to the Cape? I didn't know.
I mean, I've done it. You asked me about one place, and that's the first place that came
to
mind.
Buddy, I'm impressed. I thought you were going to say like Kalahari. You got a kid, throw him in a water park. You know?
I mean, I want to I want a cool place. I want to go snowboarding.
You're a big snowboarding guy.
All right.
You're like, in the summer? You're going to snowboard in the summer? You maniac?
In the southern hemisphere, bro. Let's go.
Yeah. I've actually looked... Punta del Este?
I've looked into the snowboarding trips in like Argentina and Chile and Uruguay.
Yeah, you go to Patagonia, right?
Yeah, I am.
Patagonia.
But yeah, they're very, very expensive. Okay. Well, speaking of holiday plans, Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa, everybody. This is our final episode of the year, leading into the holiday season, leading into the AFCON season, as well. But yeah, welcome to the Cooligans, everybody. I sound a little bit under the weather because I've been through it. And that's just how everybody's getting sick this December for some reason.
Everybody, knock on wood or whatever this table's made out of, please.
It's something's going around and every kid in every daycare is bringing it home. So
that's it. Like I said, you shouldn't have children. They're petri dishes. Don't do it.
I mean, adorable petri dishes.
I'm sure they're very cute. But if you never do it, you never get sick. Remember that, everybody.
So, welcome to the Cooligans, everybody. My name is Christian Polanco.
Hey, I'm Alexis Guerreros.
We got a hot show today, per usual. The homies joining us today, Franklin Leonard, creator of The Blacklist. You see him recently on Abby Phillips' show on CNN. And And you see him on the Cooligans as well. So,
and we talk about it. If you know what I'm talking
about. Two shows of just equal powerhouses when it comes to providing the news and bringing takes that you don't like. That's we both
read the comments. We read the comments. Also, if you're going to come to New York, you have two options. You can do CNN, but then you also got to do Cooligans. You have to do one of the two. They both start with C. It makes sense.
So, but today, let's start with some huge news in La Liga, where we got an American coach coaching in La Liga, and that has never happened before.
There are bad jobs, okay? And there are impossible jobs. And then there's a dumpster fire that is Real Sociedad right now. The club is drowning, the fans are revolting, and relegation is staring at them in the face.
So who do they call to put out the fire? Do they call a Spanish legend? No. They call a tactical genius from Italy? No.
No, they call a 6-foot-something dude from Jersey with a degree in mathematics from Columbia who looked at that sinking ship and said, I could fix her.
Today, we're talking about why Pellegrino Matarazzo just took the most dangerous job in Europe and why this is either going to be the greatest American success story since the moon landing or the end of his career.
This is the top topic.
Okay, let's start with A. First American to get a job in La Liga, huh? First American
manager. Get a job, but...
Yeah, yeah. First coach.
It's just like literally...
Manager.
Like, not allowed.
Janitor? I can't be a janitor? But this...
No, Americans, they're lazy. We don't need them.
It's a bunch of people from Barcelona with the water guns. No, turiste. Turiste, come. I don't know why I did an accent. I speak Spanish. But this is massive news for Pellegrino Matarazzo. But let's also say a lot of Americans aren't familiar with Pellegrino Matarazzo.
You're not even familiar with his name and how to say it.
I can't even say my guy. I just think bubbly water. Also sounds like he owns the best deli in Jersey.
Pellegrino Matarazzo.
The cutlets there would be insane. But he's one of these guys that like, I found out about him through an interview with Grant Wall, to be completely honest. I had seen his name that he qualified as an American. He was born an American to Italian immigrants, but he moves to Germany to play in the third division. He's fluent in German, fluent in Italian. And then he starts coaching. He did his licenses with Nagelsmann at the same time to get his coaching license. And then he gets a job with Nagelsmann and clearly impresses enough to stay at Hoffenheim. He got Stuttgart promoted, which is sort of the thing in his resume that has carried him through. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why La Real is looking at Pellegrino Matarazzo as the guy who might be able to save their season. He's sort of the Sam Allardyce. Of hopefully for La Real.
And a club like Real Sociedad they're not usually in this position. They're usually fighting for Champions League. They're currently in 16th place with 17 points, four wins, five draws, eight losses for a team that, I mean, and the team themselves. I mean, look at some of the players that they've produced. Mikel Merino. Odegaard, Superman. I mean, this is Arsenal's B team is
Arsenal took their general manager, their sporting director.
Yeah, but even now they have Kubo, who's a fantastic player. The striker for the Spanish national team that's also Oyarzabal. He's great.
Oyarzabal, yeah.
And so even with the team that they have, they clearly look like, I mean, they're giving up a lot of goals, and that is just not what we're used to seeing. They've already given up 25 goals, which is I think. About third or fourth most in the league this season. It's just like
La Liga is one of those leagues where you have teams that survive in La Liga and there's teams that are successful in La Liga. And then there's Barcelona,
right.
You know, Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid, and they stand alone. And every other team is fighting to get in those other spots. Real Sociedad was one of those teams that we would look at and say, oh, they probably will have a good year this year. You talked about how good they are at player development. They're absolutely incredible at player development. When Martin Odegaard was struggling with figuring out what he wanted to do, he went to Heerenveen. Obviously, he was already a player for Real Madrid, not getting any minutes. He goes to Heerenveen, proves he is the player they signed as a youth, right, as a very young player. But he needed a higher level. He needed to prove he could do it in La Liga. Real Sociedad is the perfect place to prove not only you could do it in La Liga, but other teams know they can poach players from Real Sociedad. It's a very high level. They're very consistently good. Now they're not that anymore. So they've been poached so much. They still got Take. They still got Oyarzabal. But they're clearly struggling. So what do? You bring in a guy like Pellegrino Matarazzo, whatever, Pelli. You bring my boy Pelli in.
But this is a name that you can't not say the full name. You have to like...
Yeah, I don't know, Matarazzo. I'm going to say Matarazzo. Yeah, I don't know why I got to say both. This is ridiculous.
Pellegrino is also not that hard of a name to say, but both together are like, there's too many syllables going on.
It's a bit much. You know what I mean? It sounds like you're calling out the back line for the Italian national team in the 60s. But you got a guy like Matarazzo, you bring him in. He plays three at the back, but it's like a fluid three at the back. He'll do 3-5-2, he'll do 3-4-3, he'll do the 3-4-1-2. Like, it just depends on the players he has. And it can be a bit defensive. It can be a little bit boring. It can be kind of pragmatic sometimes. But it seems to work. If it could get Stuttgart promoted into Bundesliga 1, then it could probably do a good enough job to at least save Real Sociedad. My worry is, Real has always been a club that has been, for the most part, on the front foot, right? They've had pretty dynamic midfielders. Is this the guy that's going to be at Real Sociedad for a long time? Or is Pellegrino Matarazzo the type of manager that's going to be now shipped across all of Europe whenever, hey, this team's got to get saved. All right, boom, you got to go to Ligue 1 and save this club. Now you got to go to here and save this club.
Yeah, I was watching the press conference with him and I was impressed. His Spanish is decent. He was reading from a statement, but he it sounded pretty good, so maybe he's going to be able to speak to the players in Spanish as well. My initial instinct is to feel a little bit worried. This is a big job. This is a very good team that has a history of, and not just even like in La Liga, we know of like how technical the players are and how stylish they may be, and Real Sociedad is that. I mean, they're not winning the title, but they're always didn't David Silva go there just to finish his career and stuff? They have especially the last like 10 years, a real distinct style that this manager, that's not his style. And the fact that the club is in this position is why he gets the job, and that's no slight on him. But they're in a more dire situation where they're actually worried about getting relegated, and they need to kind of correct the ship. So I'm a little bit skeptical is not the word. I'm just like, I hope it goes well. But I don't necessarily have a ton of evidence to believe that it will. I think this is an uphill battle for him. It's an exciting opportunity. If an American manager can, and even though he spent all his coaching time in Germany, he still has the label of an American manager. And just like the way Jesse Marsh and Bob Bradley had their opportunities in the Premier League and you know, they spoke very, honestly about like how poorly they were treated by the media, by a lot of different people. We're going to get the Spanish version of that. If Matarazzo doesn't win his first game, we're going to start seeing that, that football American phobia really, really quickly.
They, for some reason, what's it? Not the wick. What's the thing on like a bomb? You know, like light.
Yeah, yeah, it's a wick.
Is it a wick? Mm-hmm. It's short when it comes to Americans. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or anyone that goes through America, like a Wilfred Nancy, you're seeing maybe not the greatest start in Celtic, but there's full blown panic, if not already fired. There's already rumors of replacements and whatnot. So I have the same fear, but I look at someone like Pellegrino Matarazzo and I think to myself, there's not a lot of other Americans that have plied their trade only in Europe as a coach. That's rare, right? You had Bob Bradley go to Swansea, and you saw how quickly that fell apart. You had Jesse Marsh go to Leeds. You saw how quickly that fell apart.
It wasn't
and
that quick.
These are coach.
It wasn't that quick. He had like a year and a half.
That's pretty quick.
Bob Bradley was the Flash.
Bob Bradley is, within a week. He said penalty kicks? We got to get him out of here. And you had Soccer AM do Brad Bobley. character. It turned on him pretty quickly. But I get that there's like a negative connotation to like Americans or anyone that goes through MLS. This guy doesn't seem to get that. One, his name would never let you think he's American.
He's like, Pellegrino Matera, I'm Italian. What are you talking about?
What do you mean? You know? Guy pulls up in a Fiat. You know what I mean? Like he's doing everything.
New Jersey.
He's wearing one of those little...
Never heard of it.
Yeah, he's not like, it was good, everybody. He's not Sopranos Italian.
Right.
He's like Italian, which saves him a little bit. But when I look at this job, I think to myself, is this the smartest job to take, right? You've really got to believe in yourself. And the reason I say that is that he did receive a phone call. It seemed like it was customary. It seemed like it was just, hey, you're on the list for the U.S. men's national team job, but you're not really being considered for it. Yeah. But we're going to give you a celebratory, if not customary, phone call out of respect. He did receive a phone call from U.S. Soccer when they were thinking about whether to rehire Berhalter or not. So it tells you that he's at least being somewhat considered. He's considered in that echelon. But it wasn't a realistic job he would have gotten. If he turns this around for Real Sociedad, does this put him in a place where he's now considered a replacement for Mauricio Pochettino? And if he is, would he take that job? Would he not just stay in the club game?
He should take, if he could get the national team job after this goes well. After this, if this goes well, I mean, and again, there's an immense amount of pressure on.
Why don't we define what means well?
If he can get the team into a European competition, that. Because that's the standard for Real Sociedad.
They're fighting a relegation battle.
But that's the only way he becomes a national team manager.
All right,
not just keeping them up.
He saves them this year from relegation. Next season, they progress into Conference League.
You're on your way.
Yeah.
You could take over.
You get a phone call from U.S. Soccer, right? Pochettino has maxed out his contract. He's ready to go back to the club game. You think Pellegrino gets an honest shout at the job?
100%. 100%. Again, for him, I mean, this is his opportunity to. I don't think I'm saying anything that much of an exaggeration. This is the biggest opportunity of his career. Like, this is a pivotal moment. This is the hey, we think you're at this level, and we think you can do this, and. I'm sure there's plenty of people in Spanish media that were like, hey, you should not hire this guy. An American can never do this. They don't know the game. They call it soccer, blah, blah, blah. I'm sure there's so for him to get through all of that skepticism and get the opportunity and then also do well, that would make him one of the most elite American managers that has ever lived. I mean, you got to give credit where the credit is due. So, and the fact that for him to be able to get as a potential candidate for a national team manager, but then the fact that he is born in the U.S. and is also a good manager and obviously plies his trade in different countries and stuff like that. This would be a fantastic success for U.S. soccer if that, and he's also seems like a pretty nice guy and a good dude. This is him doing well here. I could change his life in such a positive way. So I'm hoping for it just to again, because it raises the credibility of other American managers, just the way Christian Pulisic in Italy and you know, playing in Europe sets the kind of a foundation for future American players to go there and to get opportunities. But we don't see that as much from the managerial perspective. So, I'm rooting for him. This is the biggest opportunity for him that he's ever had by far.
It's an interesting point because you don't really think about it, but in one fell swoop, he could go from a guy who was kind of considered. But, you know, when you think about it, Wilfred Nancy, I think, was more considered for the U.S. men's national team job, being a great coach in MLS than Pellegrino was being a great coach or a very good coach in Bundesliga,
if you put together
those two leagues, you would consider Bundesliga a much harder
But I don't think Matarazzo was a very good coach in Bundesliga. The team was okay.
Yeah, if you get Stuttgart promoted, that immediately, getting a team promoted is not easy, especially from Zweibundesliga to the top. That's tough. if you get that, there's a part of me that believes, all right, your mettle is tested. You've been able to convince a group of people to do something that is seemingly impossible, especially where Stuttgart was at the time. For him to do that, and he got Hoffenheim to beyond mid-table. They were pretty good. Right now, they're battling for a European position, if not already in one. I haven't looked at the table in a minute. But he did a pretty good job for Hoffenheim. At the end, yes, he got fired. But at the end of the day, I mean, Hoffenheim is not one of the biggest clubs in Bundesliga. It's not one of the top ones you think about, especially not right now. I know if you go back in history, I'm sure there's some Hoffenheim fan wearing a Hoffenheim shirt, scarf, and a hat right now crying that I said that. But if you go back, certainly. But as of right now, they're not one of the biggest clubs. So for him to be able to do that shows to me, okay, you've been able to promote. You've been able to inspire a team to do something that's very, very difficult. And everywhere you've gone, you've made the whole greater than the sum of its parts, which is probably another reason why La Real is saying this might be our guy. Because right now they've gotten rid of some of their best players, but they still have some talent. And we've already talked about those players. Can you make them as a group play better than what they've all kind of already done? I think he can. But if he does this, he leapfrogs everybody else who's on that list for the U.S. men's national team job post Pochettino.
I agree.
And you don't think about it. He wasn't top of the list before he got hired by La Real. And we're talking about a guy who's gotten a team promoted in Bundesliga, who's only managed in Europe. We're talking about a guy who's finished his European license. We're talking about a guy who didn't need to go to MLS. We're talking about a guy who went to Europe and successfully got hired by multiple clubs. Three clubs, if you consider Nuremberg, where he played and was like an assistant manager and then became a manager. If you consider that, that's three clubs in Europe hired this guy, now four. That's huge. He should have been higher on the list, and I don't know why he wasn't. But now, I think you're right. If he saves La Real, even gets them into, let's say, seventh place in La Liga, you're immediately the top choice for the U.S. men's national team job post-Pochettino.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, look, all due respect to Bundesliga, it's a different beast being able to succeed in La Liga. And doing it there would mean significantly more. And that's why he's not super highly, he's not highly ranked and not high on the list just for simply doing it in Bundesliga, because it's just not seen as comparatively to the other potential managers' resumes. Yes, you saw what Pochettino did and in his career. And that's an easy choice, because you put the resumes next to each other and you're like, all right, this is the guy that we're going to go with. I think the choices for U.S. soccer are usually get a big name, big resume, or let's get a local guy that knows how to speak to these players. And we just kind of flip-flop between those two. That's kind of been the era of like each national team kind of a managerial window. And after Pochettino, it's probably going to be an American manager, and Matarazzo. And if he does well, he raises his stock immediately. But if he can get, if we could turn things around for Sociedad, and yeah, it's one of those things where I'm, we don't want to get too ahead of ourselves. Let's see what the game is like this weekend. Let's see what the team looks like. Let's see what kind of happens with them and what the response is going to be from the media, from the players. I don't want to get my hopes like way too high. I think it's a, everything has started positively, and this is an exciting opportunity. I hope he does well, because I think it raises the stock for other future American managers in Europe. But yeah, I don't want to put too much pressure on Matarazzo, but that's really what's at stake right now. So, all right.
Well, you said, let's see how he does this weekend. Their game is at home against Atletico Madrid. So best of luck, Pellegrino Matarazzo.
Okay. All right. Let's take a quick break, and then
quick before we leave, he would add to the list of U.S. men's national team managers from the New York, New Jersey area. As Bob Bradley from New York, New Jersey, Greg Berhalter from New Jersey, Bruce Arena from New York. Bro, the list is long, bro. Every U.S. men's national team. Pochettino, did he live in New Jersey? Did he go to the shore or something one summer? Yeah. You got to come from that area in order to be the U.S. men's national team coach.
You got to at least make the pilgrimage, to Asbury Park.
You got to go to, like, You got to go to Wildwood. You know what I mean? You got to go to Wildwood and get some saltwater taffy at least once. If
exactly.
you want to be the manager of this national team.
All right. Let's take a quick break. We have to chat with Franklin Leonard. We talk all things Hollywood, footy, some politics, and really also how to be an artist in Hollywood while working for the worst billionaires you can imagine. So here it is. Here's our conversation with Franklin Leonard.
Absolutely thrilled to welcome back not just our next guest, but at this point, a dear friend.
Our next friend.
Yes. Okay. Just not friend that you just sometimes people are like, a friend of the show. This is like, no, it's friend of ours.
No, yeah. It's a friend on the show.
A friend.
Oh, there we go.
There he is.
I like it.
A world traveler, a man who has a passion for movies that is only equal to his passion for footy.
When this person texts one of us, I don't know if you have this, I have this feeling of like, shouldn't you be texting more important
right,
people?
Right, right. Like, does this mean I made it?
Yeah. When my phone are you not responding to Denzel Washington because you're texting me?
Denzel is not answering my text. I don't want anybody getting a misimpression that that's who I'm rolling with. But
absolutely thrilled to be joined by the founder of The Blacklist, Franklin Leonard.
Thank you for having me.
What's up, brother?
It's good to be here.
Welcome back.
I'm a fan, is the thing. So, yeah.
Well, we're fans of yours.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, did we go too far by saying friend?
No, I think it's funny.
Where do we stand?
I would agree that we are friends outside of the show. But I think, I mean, for me, this started because I was just a fan of the show. I think I rolled up in y'all's DMs. Yeah. Like, hey, I'm going to be in Norwich. Can we get together?
Yeah.
It's still crazy when you DM this. I'm like, I think this is, we got hacked.
Somebody, he did at the very least. Right. Franklin, I love that. I love when you come by here. I love when you're in New York because you, not only are since you first started doing the show, I don't know if this is the last maybe 5-6 years, but you are, I feel like a much more, you're on like political news, like talking head shows a little bit more than I think from when you first.
Yes, that was definitely not happening 5-6 years ago. There are new side quests all the time.
Yeah, which
that's become one of them.
So it's, I love that.
You hate being home.
That's the irony. I love being home. It's just that these side quests present themselves.
Yeah. I love that, when you come to New York, it's like, I'm going to be on CNN, but I gotta go see the Cooligans as well.
Exactly.
Like that is one of the stops. I'm not going to the Cooligans if I'm gonna be on CNN.
That's exactly right.
So I want to start right there because you were just on with Abby Phillips.
I was,
and this roundtable show, which was this roundtable is a little less contentious than the one that you were on.
Just a little. Although it would be fun to make it more contentious. Just go like full football banter.
Yeah, for sure.
You should do that like once every 2 months.
I imagine we invite like a MAGA guy. All of a sudden, to sit in this round table.
Well, Alexi?
The Scott Jennings of of American football.
You were just on CNN, and there's obviously a few clips that are making the rounds right now. But before we talk about that, just the nature of doing those types of shows, I've never done something like that where it's a huge platform, right? There's a lot of. Yeah. "Quote unquote normies that are watching CNN they want to know what the discourse is like about a lot of deep political issues in the country. So when you are on that on that stage, what are you psyching yourself up in a certain way to go up against these conservative perspectives? Or, how do you game plan for it?
I mean, I think for me, the first order of business is just not to embarrass myself.
Okay.
The first time
you
I
do
did
that
it,
here.
No,
that's
yeah, exactly.
That's this where it's allowed.
This is
it's
where
welcome.
The Cooligans News Network, this CNN.
Exactly.
It's you embarrass yourself.
I remember the first time I did it, like, I had this, like, image of me, like, sneezing mid thing. And then, like, there's no, it's live. Like,
right.
I have snot all over my face. That's the meme that goes viral forever. So, like, A, not embarrass myself. But two, it's funny, I don't really think about it is going up against conservatives, although that's inevitably what happens because there's a lot of nonsense being talked there. I'm just trying to like go to the core of the issue as I see it, right? Like we were talking about Epstein last time, and they were like Trump and the Democrats and blah blah blah, and I'm like, we're talking about more than 1,000 victims.
Yeah.
It's like how is that not the focus here? Like I don't care about Democrats versus Republicans versus Trump. everybody got to go.
Yeah, because
like, period.
Whoever involved.
Yeah,
they're doing the like, oh no, you know, they like Biden could have released all this stuff, and it's like, what if one of your favorite celebrities is on there? Good. That lets me know I don't need to be watching.
This does beg the question: who don't you want to be on there? Like, it would break your heart. Who would you forget?
This is the conversation that I've actually had in a few of my group chats. It's like, who would you be just devastated?
Yeah, sure.
It's Tom Hanks.
Yeah, for sure. That's
good, if Tom Hanks was in the Epstein files, it would be a rough week. I think for America.
Yeah.
I think it would be.
He's like everyone's dad.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I think.
Because you'd be like, it was that time on that deserted island. It just messed with his head.
But it is interesting. I think the Epstein files and all the conversations about it is bringing up a lot of like how. I don't know if it's just like the celebrity culture and how celebrities are more than just the people and somebody doing a movie or doing a show. It's like they're representatives of a lot of conglomerates, and they in themselves are brands, and that is what we're sort of devastated at losing, because even at Tom Hanks, he is. Cultivated a persona, and then also he is in our minds as a certain sort of figure, so that's why it hurts even more to
remember
to
when him and his wife got COVID in Australia during
that's
like,
what
early
started the pandemic,
and we were all like
the day that Tom announced that he got tested positive was, I feel like, the day that people started taking COVID seriously. Like, I think it was like less than a week later that everything shut down.
Right.
It was like that. Like, I think Rudy Gobert like putting all over the mics. No, look, I think the thing is, for me, I also think the thing about the Epstein files and the thing that I think about in the context of that, it's actually not even celebrity, right? Like Larry Summers is not a celebrity, right? Like, a lot of these dudes, Alan Dershowitz is not a celebrity. A lot of these dudes
I had his poster on my wall. I'm talking about.
Big Dersh. He wants to be a celebrity.
He wants to be a celebrity. But I think that, like, what we're talking about is just, like, a culture where powerful men can get away with all manner of absolutely awful behavior with no consequences. And there's a sort of ecosystem of these powerful men that transcends political affiliation, that transcends national identity, and they're going to protect each other. Right.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I only found out this week that it was over 1,000 victims. Like, I think if you had asked me a few days ago, I would have said a few hundred, whatever. Trump's own FBI said more than 1,000. And I mentioned that on CNN. I was like, that is, take your average American high school. It's every girl at your average American high school, the high school at the town over, and the high school at the town over from that. And that for me was just like, yo, everybody got to go.
Yeah, it's crazy. Right. And it's also,
and it's not just Epstein doing bad. Like he alone was not engaged in bad behavior. Yeah. With 1,000 people, there's a bunch of people that are involved. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he and Maxwell are the only ones that have suffered consequences thus far, not okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No. And to me, there's two parts of it. One, it seems like in order to be involved in their secret rich people, powerful people society, it's like cops. Like, I need to see you take before I know I can trust you.
Yeah.
And now I know I have dirt on you and you have dirt on me. Now we can both move on.
But then that's why these same people are the ones involved in the administration. Yeah. Who's going to take a job? This is why other people are resigning from these positions. They're like, yo, I don't want to be caught up in this
stuff.
That's
what I'm saying.
And it's like the people who are still around, it's like, yo, I can't leave because they might say something about some we did together back in 06. Yeah.
So now that's why cops all cover for each other, because they all kind of have something on them. Right?
Okay.
But the reason I bring that up is also the conversation has turned to, well, I just don't want my side to lose the argument.
Yeah, I don't care.
So it's like, oh yeah, but Clinton was involved. Right. Like, bro, go to jail. What are we talking about here? Everybody.
Who is Bubba? What was Trump doing to Bubba?
Also, Bubba needs to tell us whether he spit or swallow. You know what I mean? Like, I need to know. I need to know.
So
how dedicated was my man to the job, dog?
So I wanted
you thought about that? Let's take a poll. Do you think he spit or swallow?
I have resisted thinking about it, but it's been forced upon me.
Yeah. That's probably best. This wasn't one of the bullet points on CNN. Okay. So you were on CNN the other day.
Yeah.
And you had a bit, what's his last name? Josh?
Scott Jennings?
No, Scott Jennings.
Josh Doss.
Josh Doss. Okay, Doss. I know him as Doss Discourse on
Okay. And he's amazing.
Love him.
If you're
huge
not already a fan, you should check him out. Like, ridiculously smart.
So you're
a former college basketball player.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So you guys are having this conversation with Scott Jennings. Scott Jennings is the conservative pundit on CNN.
Yeah.
But it's starting to feel like the conservative perspective, or like the conservative person on a more left leaning, more liberal shows, mm-hmm. It's starting to be a little bit like a humiliation ritual kind of thing. Like, it's getting harder to defend some of the things that he is defending. So when you're there, having to, you're on live TV, you can't really probably speak the way you want to speak.
Correct.
So there is that, like, you're sort of politely, you're politicking even in as you're trying to be like, yo, bro, your perspectives are ass. I don't want to be listening to this.
Yeah.
So, but Scott Jennings is an easy person to dislike, I think, for a lot of left-leaning people.
Yes.
But sitting next to him, bro, what the hell is that like?
I mean, look, I think I try not to take any of the things that he says seriously. Because like I said, if I just responded as I would naturally respond, I mm-hmm. would definitely not be invited.
Right.
Right? So, you know, you end up saying things like, I have real questions for anyone who believes, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, that's me basically being like, you f***ing wild. What the hell is wrong with you?
What you just said.
You know? Yeah. But no, like, again, I think the key for me, and I think I realized this the second time I did the show, the goal was just to not let whatever nonsense he's up to distract you from the point that you're trying to make. So, like, you know, a couple nights ago, I'm trying to talk about these victims, and he's like, it's an IQ test. Don't fail it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, bro, I'm pretty sure you're not dumb enough to think that I'm dumber than you. So, like, I'm not going to be baited by this, and I'm definitely not going to distract the focus from what we're actually talking about here, which is the victims, but, like, the temptation is there. Yeah. And I'm not positive that he, like, isn't doing it for that reason. It's like, let me draw you off subject. So it's like, you know, message discipline. I learned from, you know, the mayor-elect.
Yeah.
Dude's not... Mondani never slips.
No, stay on policy.
Exactly. He all of it,
stay
bro.
On the idea. Stay on the policy. Yeah. And I think,
like, man, your beard's not trimmed up. He's like, affordability.
Yeah.
Right.
You know what's not trimmed up? The ability for people to afford eggs. Like, how did he do that? How did he dip that? I mean, you're at a point now where your opinion on more than just film, when it comes to this show, football, soccer.
Yeah.
Now you're getting asked your opinion on so many other things.
That's weird.
If you could have your own show on CNN, how much of it would be about soccer?
Right? Oh, yeah, excellent. That's an excellent question. There would be, it would be like, who's the dude on MSNBC who's always working in the hip hop?
Oh, Ari.
Ari,
love that guy.
It would be a little bit like that where, and the funny thing with Ari was when I first saw him do it, I was like, oh, this is so
right.
Like, but now I'm like, yeah, man, you do you. That's clearly who you are.
He out-cringed.
He came all the way around the other side.
You know when it turned for me? When I realized he was real. Like, he was having on, like, members of MOP
to
talk about, new bridges being built.
I was
built.
Just like, this is like, ridiculous. And yeah, and he brought it all the way back home. And I'm now like, yeah, man, that's you. And I think he's getting a lot of cred from, like, OG hip-hop folks now. Because they're like, yeah, man, you clearly get it. It would be inevitable. I mean, the thing I'm most proud of on CNN is that I worked the term Gegenpress into an episode. It was also a bet that I made with a friend of mine that I could do it.
You need to start texting him.
I worked Gegenpress into a CNN panel. So it would be inevitable, I think, is the thing. But also, like, yeah, look, I... Part of the reason I love football is that it is entwined with all of everything else.
Yeah.
Like, it's impossible to escape the extent to which, I mean, Ronaldo was at the MBS dinner.
Bro, this is...
Right?
If that disappointed anyone, you haven't been paying attention.
It's like, bro, the whole keep politics out of sports or whatever, but it's like, they're in the Oval Office.
Yeah.
It's the sport.
And if you ever argue that the Saudi Pro League wasn't just the sports wash, let me present to you new evidence.
Dude.
It's all tied together. So it'd be impossible to escape. So yeah, it would be present. It might not be like a segment every time, but it would be inescapable.
Yeah, well, you spend a lot of time in England as well. You just came back from
London. Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, I feel like I'm pretty tapped into the English subculture of, like, you know, football and where minorities play a role in that and how the news treats certain minorities. And recently that's been sort of come to a head as well with Jude Bellingham after a couple of national team games. And, you know, Ian Wright, we just watched a clip before we started about, you know, some of the things he said on the overlap. and that sensation. From your time in England, the conversation now is, when will England be ready for a black superstar? Do you think they're ready? Because they've had a few that could have been already.
Yeah, I think England's definitely ready for a black superstar. And again, I think they, I mean, like, is Saka not a superstar?
Like, right, yeah, like, what's, how do we judge this?
I mean, yeah, I mean, certainly within the Arsenal world, there is none greater at the moment, right? I think what we're really talking about is, is England ready for a black superstar to be the face of the country?
Yeah, or for the country to get behind a black superstar. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't know that I have enough information to say that one way or the other. I think I think there's a difference between whether the media, which is disproportionately white, embraces that star and sort of the inevitable like reality on the ground of, you know, who do Brits across the country, who do English folk across the country think of as their guy, right? And again, I think when we think about this team, I imagine that most people probably on the ground in the UK think of Harry Kane, and fair play, he's the top scorer in the history of the national team. And I think Saka's probably the other no-brainer name on the team sheet. So I personally find it odd that there's so much focus on Bellingham. Like, he's a great player. He plays at Real Madrid. I get it. But there's a lot of talent on that team. And I don't know that there needs to be that much focus on him. But again, I think it's two separate questions. It's like, can the media play fairly with a black star? I think we know the answer is no there. I mean, just look what happened after the penalty kicks last time, right? And then the second question is like, how do people on the ground respond? I mean, Ian Wright is basically England's uncle.
Yeah, right? That's what I'm saying. Such a dichotomy.
If there is anyone who I think of as the sort of face of English culture broadly right now that I would imagine can walk into almost any room in that country and have everybody be like, yo, that's my guy, it's Ian Wright. So I think there's a lot of different questions mixed up in that. I just, for me, there are other players that I'm more interested in than Jude Bellingham, like fundamentally. Yeah. And like, I also think that he's still young. He still needs to prove himself.
He's 22.
Yeah.
It's crazy, like, to have all this thrown on you at 22.
There was some comparison, it's usually, and this is the thing, is that like Talk Sport is there, you know, whatever it is. It's like a little, seems slightly right wing. There's a little bit, they always throw a little bit of jabs and they're like shock jocks or whatever. Yeah, yeah. But there was a comparison to like Zidane, and Zidane at 22 was at Bordeaux. And it's like, yeah, you're comparing Jude Bellingham as basically a child to the peak of a Zidane, and it just most of the time.
I dare you to ask me an important question at 22.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Dare you. I dare you.
But I also think that look, the game has changed dramatically since Zidane was 22 to now, right? Like,
Zidane didn't have social media.
No, exactly.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
There was no, you know.
Bordeaux don't even exist anymore, bro. It's crazy. It's just wine now. Think about how far we've come.
But I think that there's just a lot. There's just frankly too much pressure being placed on him. And I think he's sought it out in fairness. He's definitely sort of said, look, I'm the guy. I want to put the team on my shoulders. He's got to deliver, right? Yeah. Like, the World Cup's coming up. We'll see how things go in 2026. If he balls out, I don't think people will be able to say much. Because I also think on some level, like, you know, it comes out in the wash. But when we talk about, like, a black superstar, he needs to, on the pitch, communicate that he is, without question, the most valuable player on that team. And no disrespect to Duke, because there's a lot of valuable players there. I don't think he's there yet.
Yeah. It seems like the English media would get behind Jude Bellingham if Jude was like, enough with these immigrants. And they'd be like, suddenly.
Okay, finally.
Speaking
my language.
Here's the thing. Jude has a hat trick in a World Cup final and brings a trophy home.
Yeah.
I don't think we're going to be able to have a question. People aren't going to be talking about Phil Foden.
No. Well, they'll be talking about his three assists.
You were at the game, the England-Serbia game. So you saw the Eberechi Eze's goal.
I did.
This was a big, like, talking point, because the announcers during the game, none of us heard it.
Yeah.
You were obviously at the game, but we were hearing afterwards, the announcer was like, what a fantastic pass from Phil Foden.
Well, Eberechi was asked about it.
Yeah, that was actually asked about it as well. But even after, when you look at the whole play, the Jude Bellingham pass is what broke the lines and gave Phil Foden the opportunity to even make that pass. But the goal was unbelievable.
And by the way, the second Eze got on, his entire vibe changed up the game. So like the idea that like the focus wouldn't be on him is a little ridiculous.
Right.
Because there was another one where he should have scored, and it was all him. But again, like, these are things that people aren't. I don't even know if they're necessarily doing it consciously. It's just that they're oblivious. And obliviousness is embarrassing for everybody involved.
Weird. Yeah. My conspiracy theory is that it's intentional. That mm-hmm. The acting dumb in the Phil Foden thing is like yeah. a little like that's a goofy version of right. this, but it does feel the sort of the aftermath and the constant talking about Jude Bellingham as if he's a problem, which I right. literally like he is literally not a problem, no. and finding ways to sow discord amongst this team is I think that is intentional from some media outlets or individuals.
I don't think you're wrong about that. I think there's also just like they need a story, right? Like
right,
what's
right.
if there's the added benefit that you can sell that story to certain audiences because it's like bad young black man.
Right.
Sure. Like this is not a new phenomenon, sure. unfortunately.
yeah. Who was the boxer that way back in the day was like dating white women and speeding down the
road. Oh, Jack Johnson.
Jack Johnson. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Didn't care about like speeding tickets or whatever.
No. Yeah. Like actively and literally they like the phrase great white hope came yeah. from. We got to find somebody to beat this yeah, man.
Can somebody beat this guy, please? Because yeah. he was putting it back in their face.
Yeah.
But it's so funny. They're treating Jude Bellingham because, you know, he did this when he scored as if he's Jack Johnson.
But that's the wildest part to me is Jude Bellingham also strikes me as like terribly boring.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's just like he goes and plays football. Yeah, he goes home. And like if the most offensive thing about him is that he celebrates theatrically, like yeah. what are we doing here? I mean, I think the other thing that Ian mentioned in that video that I thought was really interesting, you know, he talked about N'Golo Kanté, who is my favorite player of all time. Like, period. And the fact that he's still out there, I really hope he ends up on the French team. Like, sure. that might actually get me into a stadium for the World Cup. But my other favorite player of all time is Mario Balotelli, who is literally
yeah,
the
dude.
Opposite.
Yin and yang.
It's literally yin and yang. It says a lot about my psychology, by the way. But I think that this is just the reality of being a person of color in the world, yeah. right? You are not going to get the same evaluative metrics as your white counterparts. You're
right.
just not. And it sucks, but it's also the way things are. And for me, when I look at the people who are doing that, you're either doing it because you're dumb or because you're an asshole. You tell me which it is.
Sure.
But neither of them are good. Like, frankly, I'd almost rather you be the asshole, because if you're dumb, that's just sad for you.
Mm-hmm. And this all goes back to Scott Jennings.
But that's the subtext of what I'm getting to. It's like, look, man, look, you can choose, but neither of them are good.
Right.
And neither are a good excuse. Neither are a good excuse. And both are just kind of sad and pathetic for you. And that's kind of my reaction to all of this stuff is I've sort of stopped getting mad about it. I'm just like, oh, that's pathetic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a question, because we've talked a lot about football. We've talked a lot about where the politics place yeah. is. What you're primarily known for is the Blacklist, right?
Yeah.
Which, again, is only for black people. That's why I named it that. No, all jokes aside, it's obviously you're in the film business. You're yeah. in the script business.
And, you know, I'll just add this. It is a legit meritocracy when
that's
it comes
the goal.
To
yeah, yeah, yeah. No, but that is
compared
actually
to
the goal.
What people
yeah.
say yeah. other institutions are.
But you've made your base this industry that right now people are wondering, is it dead? Is it real? Is it just yeah, Marvel yeah. movies that we're ever going to see from now on? But also, why are all these companies building billion-dollar studios on the East Coast? You've got Netflix building studios mm. here. Jersey's got two. Yeah. I think Lionsgate is building one.
Or data centers for AI.
Well, forget the data center part. But just the, like, why are we building studios on the East Coast? The industry's dead. You're front line. What are you seeing? Is the film industry going to exist?
Yeah, of course it is. I mean, I think that, like, I've been in the industry for like 23 years now, and the number of times that I heard it's all over. Mm-hmm. It's like a monthly thing, right? First it was streaming, now it's AI, now it's consolidation. Like all these things, they're not necessarily good for film culture, right? Like it's bad that there are an increasingly smaller number of companies that can finance a big movie. But if you look around this year, there are a bunch of great movies this year, right? Like for all of the like Sturm und Drang around like, oh, it's all over, we're not making good movies, it's just Marvel movies anymore. Have you seen Sinners? Have you seen One Battle After Another? Have you seen Hamnet? Have you seen Marty Supreme? Have you seen Sentimental Value? Have you like there's some bangers out this year. And by the way, there are bangers every year. And so I think the challenge is not are the studios making $200 million movies that everybody wants to see, right? They'll figure that out. Question is are there filmmakers who are figuring out how to make good movies and put them out into the world? And then as an audience, like, we got to go find them. Like, we have to make the extra effort to, like, make sure that those films have an audience make money, and that those filmmakers can then go make their next movie.
Isn't there something to be said, like how rappers have like decided, I don't want to sign. Signing for a big label is essentially a bank loan, right?
Yeah, right?
So if I stay independent, there's distribution networks that will get my product out the same as if I'm on a major.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something to be said that if that middle core of filmmakers and scriptwriters that are maybe too abstract to be on the big films, too talented, too good of a director, too artistic, too creative, if they used to fill out that middle core, which is like a lower budget major, now they're back to being independent filmmakers.
Yeah.
Isn't there something to be said for a distribution network that distributes your indies? Because those are the films we're all talking about that are no longer being made.
Yeah.
Now they're just not easily found.
Well, so I think that's the biggest challenge, right? Fundamentally, like music you can make and distribute for pretty cheap, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can set up a studio in your bedroom, you can make the music, you can put it on the internet pretty cheaply. Making a film, like even a cheap film, probably $100,000, millions of dollars. You want to put it in theaters, you're definitely looking at millions of dollars. And so how do you get that money, right? If it's not the $1,000 you need to make an album, right? That I think is one.
Wait, hold on. The filmmaker pays for the movie to be in theaters?
No, but the distribution company. The distribution. Right?
Okay.
And so, but
doesn't the theater companies just make it back on tickets? Like,
if it's marketed well and if people show up. But how are we going to let people know that the movie exists? How are you going to let people know that it's in this theater on this date, on this time, and it's worth your time? I think that's the real sort of question for the future, which is, okay, we know the studios are going to make their big Marvel movies. Occasionally, they'll make Sinners or One Battle After Another. Shout out Mike DeLuca and Pam Abdi at Warner Brothers, who greenlit both of those. But where can a filmmaker go who has something pretty non-traditional that will only cost $5 million. Where can they go to get that $5 million and get a distribution channel that will allow an audience to find out about it? And if it's really good, that filmmaker and the company that distributed it will make a lot of money. I think that's what A24 has tried to be, Neon. There's a bunch of these distributors that
are A24 now owns restaurants, right?
Like, but that's the thing. It's like the sort of the appeal of endless growth and like being a billion-dollar company. They obviously grow bigger. Now they got restaurants and theaters. And so I think... Yeah,
Cherry Lane. Yeah, they own the Cherry Lane Theater. Yeah.
But where is that layer of financiers and distributors that smaller budget filmmakers can access that will allow their work to get to audiences who are looking for good stuff?
I was thinking about this. The reason why I asked the question seemed with a little bit of deep knowledge was because I was thinking about this, right? My first love was filmmaking. Mm-hmm. I got accepted to Tisch, couldn't afford to go.
Yeah.
So I never did it. So I always had filmmaking in the back of my head as something I would love to eventually try one more time before I hang it all up. And I was like, you know what? Theaters are struggling, right? Because there's not the big budget films don't happen as often, right? Theaters are struggling, but they have the spaces. It's like a comedy club. It's a terrible business idea. I'm going to open up a bar and only be open 4 hours a night, three nights a week.
Right.
It's a terrible business idea. What are you doing the other days, right? So you take these theaters. There's dating apps. A lot of people going on first dates. Tell the dating, if you guys met on a dating app, you can come into this theater and watch a movie for half off at like noon or one or three, whatever.
That's actually pretty good. I've actually never heard that idea. Like,
but you don't know what you're about to see. You're just going to be shown an independent film
yep.
or maybe two shorter films.
I think AMC
basically,
has
I just recreated like, television. I didn't realize that's what I was doing. I'm like, wait, something's going to be on. You don't know what it is. exactly. I'm an idiot.
It always comes back. No, I actually think AMC's app has something like that. It's not tied to the dating thing, but they definitely have a like mystery movie every Friday maybe or something like it where like you don't know what it is. You're just going to show up. But weirdly, I like the idea of the dating app combo idea.
Mm.
You might be onto something there.
Okay.
Hold on.
I've definitely never heard you it before.
You let Alexis continue. He's just going to be like, how about a brothel?
How about this? You don't know what girl either. It costs 200 roses an hour.
Oh, Lord.
Christian's not wrong, by the way.
But the idea of...
Cut a hole in the popcorn. I'm spitballing here.
You match over, you have similar taste, and then you can go to a movie at a discount?
Because you people suck at talking to girls. I give you something to talk about now. You guys just watch the same film.
So,
you know where the idea came from? I was on a plane, and I was bored. And I was like, let me find the most obscure film on this airplane. And it was James Gandolfini and Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
That's a great movie.
Great film.
Great film.
The most independent film I've seen in a long time. Yeah. I'm like, you could tell there was so much passion behind the characters that they were like, we don't really need to do anything else. Like, focus on, it was like very Scorsese, just focus on the dialogue, everything else, who cares? But what I loved about it, I'm like, I would have loved to have just shown up to a theater, comfortable seat, popcorn, the whole nine, and just have this randomly played. I would have left in awe of this film because it just popped up. And if it wasn't for Tony Soprano and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, two of my favorite characters of all time, or my favorite actors, just happened to be on this thing, I would have never clicked on it.
My tip, if that's the experience you're looking for, like, honestly, like, go to Metacritic, the website. It's a sort of like Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's a little bit better statistically, but go to Metacritic. Go look at, like, the top movies of the year, the top movies that are out now, and just choose something with a rating above 85. Like, the odds of it not going well are very low.
How do you and I make millions off this? Forget Metacritic. How do you and I
if I could figure out how to make millions, believe me, I would probably not be doing this podcast right now. But no, like
we'd have to argue with Scott Jennings all day.
Exactly. No, but, like, fundamentally, there are great movies available. And I think that every year I hear people, all of my Twitter mentions, like, Hollywood is ruined. There are never any good movies. And I'm like, well, have you seen this? Have you seen this? Have you seen this? And they're like, no. And I'm like, well, then you can't say that there are no good movies. There are lots of great movies. It's just they don't have $200 million marketing.
There are less movies being made, though. You are seeing that real time.
There are less movies being distributed in theaters post-pandemic, for sure. I think it's down like 33%.
So I'll add on to this. I'm curious about kind of the art as a whole, when it comes to you are mentioning, like, financing a lot of these big budget films and things like that, or even financing a small budget film. You have to, you had just mentioned Mayor-elect Mom Dani, and I got the opportunity to host the Cost of Living Classic. So affordability is obviously a big talking point. You know, being an artist in New York, it's obviously very hard to live here and continue to do that. So I think what this political landscape that we're in now is that the art world is also kind of battling with the affordability crisis. And then also, yes, if you want to finance something, you probably have to work with some very, very wealthy people.
Yes.
And I think we're sort of seeing the cloak being removed on, like, how all this stuff works and who owns what and what billionaires are doing this or what other money do they have in this, or are these, like, movie studios sort of do they exist to sort of clean the image of certain people and things like that? So when
you're talking money laundering?
Not money laundering. No, literally, like,
because I'm interested if you are. I need to figure this out.
Just something that influences the culture to perceive people
culture washing.
Exactly. Washing exists,
the Weinsteins did it, right? That was part of their whole thing. So, at least hiding.
Right. So we talk about Epstein and all that and things like that. So when it comes to balancing those two things, as someone who wants to create art, but then also, especially you are probably have conversations with very wealthy people to try to raise money for projects. What is there a thing that artists should be feeling of, like, navigating this through in a different way, or do they feel sort of their morals have to come into question of, like, who they work with and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that the first part of the question about just the affordability question and being an artist. Yeah, like, most artists, if you didn't grow up rich, you're going to start poor. And it takes it's not like you can just go to law school and then go to a law firm and just work your way up to partner and then you're good. Being an artist is a lot of poor for a long time, and then maybe you break through and then you're a little less poor and so on and so forth, right? Like, it takes a long time to build a career as an artist. And so
it's also hard to become sustainable financially.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, we sort of have this model in the U.S. where it's like, no, you should work a day job and do your arts on the side, and eventually you can make that switch, maybe, right? And so affordability is really, like, as one of the things I was really interested in about Mom Dani and really all the other folks that are focused on the affordability crisis, like, that is a good thing for the arts. Like, if you make it less expensive for people to live their lives, there will be more people who are likely to be artists, and you will likely get better movies and better TV shows, right? So, like, think about if you're annoyed about the taxes, think about it as just like a supplement to your film and TV budget. Sure. Eventually, you're going to get better because people will be able to figure out being a better artist, and we're not just going to get art made by rich kids, right? I mean, I make this joke all the time, but, like, there's a reason why there's so many working Canadian actors and working British actors in the U.S. because they had healthcare. Yeah. They could work on their craft and get good, knowing that if they got, you know, a hangnail, they wouldn't die or be bankrupted. And then when they were great, they came over here. Same with Australia, right? Now, the question of, like, who are you going to work with and are they morally compromised? I tend to believe that any very, very, very large pile of money is never morally pure. Like, that's just a sort of default assumption that I make. And so it's inevitable that you're probably going to make compromises when you're asking somebody for $20 million or $200 million. Because, like, what did that person have to do to get $20 or $200 million that they could just be like, yeah, let me write you a check.
Sure, sure. Right? This is nothing to me.
There are very few morally pure fortunes. And so I think that every artist, every person, I think, has to sort of come to their own conclusions about, like, what are the compromises I'm going to be willing to make? And, you know, if you don't have any food and someone offers you food for any number of things you find morally objectionable, you may just make the compromise. Right. Right? Yeah. Someone offered me $1 billion tomorrow for something that I find morally objectionable. That's very different than somebody offering me $10 to do something that I find morally
objectionable.
You'll
be like, yes, I will become an ICE agent.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Kim Jong-un. Why are you asking, eh?
But real talk. Like, if someone came to you and said, look, I'm going to write you a check for $1 billion. All you got to do is be an ICE agent for a year.
I'm gonna be the worst ICE agent, actively undermine things, but I'll be the worst
after like three or four people I really don't like that I arrest. I got a list of cousins I'm not really messing with. But then after that, I'm gonna be
there.
Crazy.
We go.
Yeah.
Right. And then you maybe take 10% of that. You take $100 million afterwards, and you donate it to a good cause. Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know, but I just think that everybody has
every 2-3 million. You know? Whatever I'm not willing to hide. You know?
Exactly. Let's see what we're at after.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But no, I think
I can hear you from my yacht, Franklin.
I got everybody swim lessons so they can come. Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's like there's always moral and ethical compromise on some level in every aspect of our daily lives, and I think we just have to be, you know, conscious of it.
I think we're all talking about something I don't think the general public understands. Let's say you wrote a movie, mm-hmm. It got greenlit by some major studio. They want to make it. You want to hire Christian and I to be your lead actors in it. The movie's gonna fail, but. You pick all the major actors, everything comes together, and then you say, okay, we have our stars, we have everything. Now we need to go find the money.
Right.
Most people think the studio writes you a check, but that's not true. You have to go and get people with money to say, yeah, I want to produce this film.
That's if it's an independent film. So there's a few different ways it works, right? Like if I write a screenplay, I can, maybe I find a producer who wants to be my producer. They may take it to a studio and the studio may say, we love this, we want to buy it. And then once you've got the cast, once you've got the director, the studio will pay for it. Right?
Okay.
Sinners is a great example of this, right? Like Ryan Coogler, most commercially and critically successful filmmaker across his first 5 films since Steven Spielberg. He says, hey guys, I got a script I want to make. And all the studios say, please tell us more. Like, what do you want? And then Warner Brothers says, all right, we'll write you this check, whatever. And they're off and running.
Where do they get that money? That's their own money.
That's their own money.
Okay. Yeah.
And then, you know, you have other projects where it's like, I write this movie. Maybe it's like a coming of age story about like a 13-year-old soccer player in Georgia. I got to go find that money because Warner Brothers isn't going to give me $100 million to make that movie. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to find a producer. I'm going to find some actors who may want to be in it. And then we're probably going to go try to find independent film financiers. Some of them are companies. Some of them may be individuals who are just rich to put that money in. And then we're probably going to have to make that movie. And then hopefully it plays at the festivals or we're able to show it to a few studios and the studios see the finished version and they're like, yes, we'd like to buy that.
And then they do well with it. They distribute it themselves.
Yeah.
Where did, like, let's say I'm a rich person, mm-hmm. and I want to finance one of your films. Where do I get my money back? This is all for a reason.
It's a weird question. It really depends on what you negotiate. So you may get your money back. You'll probably get your money back when the studio acquires the film.
Okay, because let's say
it was a $10 million budget. I write a $10 million check. You go off and make the movie. Movie plays at Sundance. Studio wants to buy it for $20 million. I'm probably getting that 10 back then. Probably 10 plus a vig. And then I'm probably going to get some participation in the upside once the movie gets distributed to the audience.
Right, you know what a vig is?
I've heard it on Sopranos plenty of times. Yeah.
But vig is a little taste. I love that you use vig. But the reason I ask is with... finances going the way they are and you know there's billionaires and there's people that don't have much, can't there be something said about maybe banks filling in that space or, you know, people with like large Bitcoin holdings? someone just to say like, I'm going to give you the money as a loan. And then I get paid back a certain percentage. And maybe that's like a steam engine that can create more of these films.
There definitely are loan folks that sort of function that way, where they're like, look, I'm not trying to get rich here, but I will give you a loan and I'll give you 10 and I expect 12 back by this date. The problem is also just that like film is incredibly risky. Most of those movies that cost $10 million are not going to make $10 million back. And so you want to be in a position where you're making six movies, five of them flop, but that one is a massive hit and that, you know, it sort of removes the other debt. So you need that upside for it to really work long term.
It's crazy that we're still talking about it this way.
I mean, here's my idea. Make the movie tickets $1 million each.
Yeah. And it's like the Wu-Tang album.
I got another idea. I got eight iPhones. All right. Hear me out. Why you need a $10 million check? I got this guy who works on a bodegas only on the weekends.
All right. I want to wrap up. We decided we were going to surprise you with a little game.
Oh, no.
So all we right. have a game. We should have talked about it beforehand, but we did not. But I think it'll be fun. We're going to be taking penalties right now.
You just have to answer yes or no.
You just got to answer yes or no, but you're going to be the goalkeeper.
Okay.
And
I get a piece of paper?
Sure. The penalties that we will be taking are, is this person in Franklin Leonard's phone? So we're going to be guessing names.
We're just guessing contacts.
We're going to be guessing names. So we each have five. Obviously, we're trying to win. So if you say yes, they are in your phone, then that is a make. And if
we define in my phone, do I need their phone number or email?
I would say phone number.
Does email address count?
Email if you've communicated before.
Okay.
Directly.
Yeah. Email counts.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Okay. Yeah. So,
but not like
they were CC'd.
Okay. So you've had correspondence.
You know what? If they've specifically reached out to you, then yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's okay. That's
all right. Then I don't even care if that's like, you know, that a counts. DM.
All right. All right. Who goes first you in go these trends? I go first. Okay. My first take. I'm going to say Michael B. Jordan.
No.
Ooh, you took a North guy. Nope.
Wow. Okay, I thought
we met, but like he's not on my phone.
Okay.
Okay. I said the name before, and you didn't say no, so I'm gonna say Denzel Washington.
Not in my phone.
Ooh. Damn. Okay. We're both.
By the way, y'all just might not. We might be like 16th penalty, just like naming a random ass names.
All right.
Y'all also just might think I'm more famous and well connected than I actually am.
That's fair. That's
yeah,
fair.
Yeah, I do think you are. I just said Denzel Washington.
Okay. Yeah. I feel confident about this one. This is the top corner I'm going for. Jason Sudeikis.
Yes.
Hey, let's go.
Okay, you got one. Okay. Just because she's been around for a while, I'm going to say Whoopi Goldberg.
No.
Oh.
No, I would love it. Okay. Like a proper EGOT in my, that would be great, but no.
Okay.
All right. I'm up next. This is a long shot, but I feel like it's possible. President Barack Obama.
Not in my phone.
Oh.
We've met, but not in my phone.
I mean, not in my phone.
Y'all definitely.
Means like somewhere. Yes.
There's back signal.
Y'all definitely signal. Think I. Here's what I. What this has revealed is y'all think I'm more impressive than I actually am.
Yeah, which is good.
It's flattering.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm going to leave and you're going to be like, damn, we definitely should not have him on the show again.
I'm going to pick someone from the political spectrum, but kind of newer, Caitlin Collins.
Not in my phone.
Damn, I stink at these pens.
Okay. I feel good about this one too. I think there's a possibility here. Issa Rae.
Yeah, I think she's in my phone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go.
All right. I need a win here. Aaron West.
Yeah.
All right, I just needed a name.
Okay, yeah, we got it.
That's when the goalkeeper scores one.
Okay. I'm going to go with, now my name's, okay. This is just because I've had a crush on her for a long time.
Okay.
Julianne Moore.
No, not in my fifth.
No, okay.
But definitely crush worthy.
Got it. Okay. So that was my fifth. What about you, Alexis?
All right. This is my fifth. This one's, buddy, this one's reaching for the sky. Alec Baldwin.
No.
Okay, that's it. I win.
2-1
2-1
Let's go.
I thought you went Caitlin Collins, but not Abby Phillip.
Yeah.
You know what? I probably should have done that.
All right. Well, now we know where Franklin Leonard lies.
Clearly lower than where you thought it was.
Yeah, I did start with Denzel. Michael B. Jordan was on my list.
I will say there are others. There are others who are, and we can play this game again at some point in the future. Who are similar, but you just y'all just guessed the wrong direction.
We went around it.
I was going to say Ryan Coogler.
Yes, Coogler. Coogler,
a screenwriter I stayed away from because that's obvious.
That's fair. But Coogler, I met Coogler at Sundance the year Fruitvale Station came out, and literally that dude is one of one. I've never met anybody like him.
100%.
Also, one of the people you mentioned, he said he would reach out to on our behalf, so I kind of knew that already.
Sure. But
That's why I threw an arrow.
No, when you talk about like marketing films, when Sinners came out and the marketing behind it,
and
the fact that he was the face of it, and his not only his face, his voice, his personality, he's such a unique...
like him talking about like film stock, just like, all right, so the 70 millimeter.
I was obsessed with watching all that, so all the BTS stuff that he did.
Ryan is the best of us in like every way.
Love it. That's awesome. Franklin Leonard,
I think we solved the film.
We solved politics.
Tie it to dating apps.
The economy. You know,
it's not the worst idea I've heard.
I mean,
I'll take that.
You know how the dating scene is super chill now anyway?
Yeah.
It's a good
Thank God.
Let's put these people in dark rooms and they've never met. That'll solve everything.
Franklin Leonard, is there anything you want to plug or let anybody know about? Anything you got working on?
Let's see. I'm on Substack. I'm inevitably writing about soccer there occasionally.
All right.
I wrote a little bit about the sort of Africa qualifiers and that Nigeria match. Just search for me on Substack.
What is the basis of the Substack? Is there a specific direction?
There's not. It's
the
thoughts
of Franklin Leonard.
It's bullying myself into doing more long form writing.
I love that.
Yeah,
that's
great. Yeah, and obviously with these World Cup qualifiers, this has been. I probably should have talked about this, but real quick, these World Cup qualifiers. I had posted on Blue Sky the other day. I was just like that. I feel like the qualifying for the World Cup, it feels more exciting than the World Cup itself because seeing the scenes when Haiti qualified, and Haiti has been having to play their games in everywhere but Haiti.
Yep.
They're not even allowed in the country. Isn't that crazy? It's so stupid.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah. That's a really good point.
Nigeria missing out on the World Cup. Like,
Nigeria missing out was bad. Us not getting the Nigerian Nike kits is even worse.
Yeah, dude.
Well, they're going to release them anyway.
Are you sure?
Yeah, they always do. Remember when the U.S. didn't make it, we still got that weird.
Sure. But will they still do it for the Nigerian ones?
Yeah, because the U.S. ones when we didn't qualify.
Would they be worried that they won't sell as much? I mean, I guess.
They're still good. I'm still copping. Yeah.
These qualifiers. This is where the expansion of the World Cup. Sometimes, like when you first see it, you're like, "Oh, we don't need more teams." And then you get some of the stories, Cape Verde. Haiti. These stories.
How are you guys not on my team of wanting a World Cup every 2 years? Look how amazing this is. No,
because I'm just all in on the regional tournaments too. That's the thing. Like, you get like 4 World Cups.
Yeah, but then you get that the following year. And that's how that's part of how you qualify.
No, that's too much.
It's a little too much.
I'm ready for AFCON coming up in December 15th for a month. I think the World Cup's going to be really exciting. I was always pro the expansion to 48. I know that was unpopular initially, but I think there will be vindication.
All right. Okay. Franklin Leonard, dude, you're welcome back anytime. Anytime you're in New York, hit us up, brother. We always appreciate
Flattered. It. Flattered. Even though I'm not as famous as you clearly thought that I was.
It's been a sad realization.
If anybody plays that game with us, your name is going to be the big one that's on ours.
It's like when you learn your dad isn't a superhero.
Right, exactly. It's like, Dad, you can't dunk.
Yeah. You guys had dads?
There we go. That's a perfect place to end. Cheers.
Shout out to Franklin Leonard, the homie coming through. Always lovely to see him when he comes by New York City. And one of his stops, he's like, yo, I got to text the Cooligans and talk to some footy. Sometimes I feel that a lot of our more either successful or established friends are especially established in other fields that are not like in the soccer world, are like, I need somebody to talk soccer with. And these are my guys. And Franklin,
well, we are here for that. If you are really successful in something other than soccer and you want to chit chat about the game, buddy, welcome to the studio.
It's like a little bit of like, you know how you go see a therapist to get something off your chest? Mm-hmm. That's kind of how what we are.
You know, I thought about this with the Mamdani interview. Where else are you going to be able to talk about soccer to the depth? Like, yeah, Adam Friedland brought it up, but his show's not about, like, what do you think Arsenal's doing this weekend? What do you think about the men's national
league? Right.
You got to come to us. Timothy Chalamet, you know, growing up, his nickname was Soccer Timmy. He lived in the same building as, what's his name, Mule, who used to play for Red Bull and now plays for Nashville.
Oh, okay. Alex Mule, yeah.
Alex Mule. He used to carry around a soccer ball with him everywhere he goes. He's a fan of San Etienne. You could have little bits of those questions everywhere you go. Buddy, where are you going to have that whole cover, Timothy? Come right
exactly.
here.
Exactly. Why are you wasting your time with Drewski? You ain't getting views.
I don't know nothing,
Drewski.
Bro. You don't care about these rappers, dog. Come talk to your unks about San Etienne, bro.
Yeah, though. We have a lot of thoughts on French soccer, bro.
Yo, I know how to save Ligue 1. It's okay. Going to be your money, but just listen to the rest of the pitch, Timothy.
So, thank you again, Franklin. Everybody, go check out the Blacklist, especially if you have a screenplay that you want to submit. Happy holidays to everybody. This is our last episode of the year. We had a fun and wild 2025, us and everybody at Yahoo Sports. And 2026 is only going to be even more intense, especially with a World Cup on our shores. So a lot to look forward to.
I know it's not Thanksgiving, right? And I know we gave thanks already, but as I think about the whole year, I want to thank two people in particular. I want to thank Carter and I want to thank Ingrid. They're our producers. All the hard work that they put into the show made this year a wild success.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Alexis, thank you. Look at that. Alexis, thank
I'm
you.
A great person. I don't know what to tell you. And also, super humble.
Alexis, rebranding for 2026.
Yeah. You know what? I'm tired. I'm tired of reading the comments saying that I'm an asshole. Actually, those are just texts from my mom. But nonetheless, I do want to thank you because I know everybody puts in hard work. Obviously, Christian, I know you put in hard work. You know I put in hard work. But everyone that you don't get to see on camera all
do
the time.
Do I know that you put in? Okay.
Okay. Well, apparently not. Okay. The rebranding will then continue for 2027. But we got a big, massive 2026. We got a lot awesome planned for the World Cup. We've got a lot of awesome stuff planned for this year. It's going to be a lot, man.
It's going to be a busy, fun year.
And also, this may be the last episode of the podcast, but check out our YouTube. We have a cool video coming out next week, so we're not missing a week there. If you're not already on the YouTube, hit the subscribe button, bro. What you waiting for?
Yeah, there's a lot of fun going on over
there. As long as you want to watch us on YouTube, don't hit the subscribe button and then never check back in. You're kind of screwing us over.
So, everybody, have a good rest of the holiday. Have a happy new year. We will see you. We'll be back on January, 5th? If I'm not mistaken.
You doing resolutions this year?
Resolutions. I'm going to do a resolution. I want to,
I can feel him being sentimental coming up.
No, it's not sentimental. I am going to work on learning a new language. I did French for like a year and I really practiced and I was like, I dedicating myself to it, but I really want to, I would love to be able to do an interview in French and an interview in Portuguese. That's like my dream. So those are I don't think I can get both done in 1 year, but that's what I'm going to be working towards. So
weird dream. Not going to lie to you.
Learning languages you sure is weird.
In French or Portuguese. Hey, enjoy. Do whatever you want. My New Year's resolution, I did already, was to give bullshit thank yous to our producers. So they did it already.
You're all done.
Didn't mean a word of it, baby. I got away with it. No, I'm kidding. Love you guys. I don't know what my New Year's
April
resolution
Fool's
will be.
Resolution.
Yeah, dog. Got you. y'all slipping, dog. You thought I was going to be nice? No, I don't know what my New Year's resolution is going to be, but I have a feeling it's going to involve some type of weight loss or get healthier. Whatever.
It sounds like
I want to buy my doctor a Porsche. Apparently.
It sounds like your resolution is being forced upon you by somebody else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think my wife's whispering in my ear, you know, while I sleep.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for tuning in the entire year. We appreciate it. Seriously, the support from Cooligans fans is incredibly priceless to us and so incredibly meaningful. So thank you again. And we'll see you in 2026 with more banger episodes, incredible guests. We already have a couple pre-taped ones that you got to look forward to. So January is going to be pretty fire. So be on the lookout for that. So everybody, thank you. Have a good rest of the holiday and a happy new year. Take care, everybody. Peace.
Love you guys.